From KTOO, I'm Katie Anastas with a look at local and statewide news. Juneau's emergency cold weather shelter is open on nights when temperatures dip below freezing. Resurrection Lutheran Church has run the shelter for the last 2 years. Earlier this summer, the congregation declined to host it again this winter. Members again voted no when they met to reconsider on Sunday. After the vote, Pastor Karen Perkins said she was stunned.
I really don't know what the city is going to do.
Last winter, the church was prepared to serve around 50 people per night. Some nights, 70 people slept there. Perkins says she's proud of that work.
I think it was good for the community. I think it was good for these people that I've come to know and love.
In June, the congregation voted on whether to apply to rent it again this winter. That vote was evenly split, so they didn't submit a bid to the city. Neither did any other organizations in Juneau. So the congregation's president called another meeting where they could reconsider. They held the meeting after Sunday's church service. Perkins started with a prayer.
Gracious God, draw your church together, oh God, into this one great company of disciples.
More than 20 people sat in the church's pews. Others joined on Zoom. Deputy City Manager Robert Barr spoke to the congregation.
I'll be frank and blunt. We don't have a great alternative.
Last month, Barr told the Juneau Assembly that the alternative might be a decommissioned city bus kept idling overnight. Still, some members of the congregation asked whether other city-owned buildings could house the shelter. Barr said the city's warehouse in Thane wouldn't work because the city needs it for storage year-round. The unused part of the downtown transit center isn't big enough. The Juneau Arts and Culture Center, where St. Vincent de Paul ran the warming shelter during the pandemic, is now back in use by the arts organization. But that wasn't enough to convince the congregation. Congregation President Karen Laufer says seven more voted no than yes.
I'm just really very sad and disheartened because I think that, you know, you read about what's happening up in Anchorage, and we're going to see that to some extent. There's no question about it.
Anchorage has already broken its record for the number of outdoor deaths in a year. Laufer said the first vote was before the city's deadline for bids. She thinks some people voted no then because they thought another provider would offer to run the warming shelter instead.
I think that some individuals thought that, well, someone else would do it, and now that there's nobody else to do it, I don't know what they're thinking. I honestly don't know what they're thinking.
She's not sure what will happen next for the people who relied on the warming shelter.
I'll be walking down the street and they'll stop and... Or the police will stop and go, well, what are these people going to do? And people ask me, what am I going to do? And I don't have an answer for them now.
The city's seasonal campground closes in mid-October. The Glory Hall's 55 emergency shelter beds are full. So are their permanent supportive housing units. Barr says he's meeting with other local providers this week to discuss alternatives. But those providers lack a large enough space for the shelter. He says the bus is still the last-ditch option. Alaska has seen a big jump in refugees over the past 2 years. Last year, there were over 500 entering the state, and all of them must learn how to access healthcare quickly, often in a language that isn't their first. Catholic Social Services in Anchorage teaches new arrivals about health and healthcare, and they've had to expand their services to meet this growing need. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has the story.
Lillian Montoya immigrated to the United States from Mexico 17 years ago. One day, she was home alone with her young son when his fever spiked so high that his fingers started turning blue.
One time I called the 911 because my son gets sick. And I didn't know what to do. And I can't even explain them what happened. So I just remember the blueberries and I say, blueberries, fingers.
She ended up getting her son to the emergency room, but she says it took her more than 2 years to feel like she really understood the U.S. healthcare system.
When you arrive in a different place, you don't know nothing. So I remember that I have to investigate everything by myself. And now I say, well, if I know the answer, why am I going to make people suffer if I can provide that information?
Montoya now shares that knowledge in her job as a case manager and health advocate for Catholic Social Services. She works with refugees, teaching health classes, working one-on-one, and giving each new refugee a 3-hour health orientation. It's part of a larger effort that Catholic Social Services launched in 2016 to make sure refugees understand the complex and often baffling U.S. healthcare system. To meet growing demand this spring, they started offering new classes and screenings through Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center. On a recent afternoon, 20 refugees sit in rows in the Catholic Social Services Welcome Center and listen as Abdul Wahidi talks about how to make appointments and what to bring with you on your doctor's visits. Kids run around the room.
Okay, if you want to change your schedule or appointment, you have to call the medical or the clinic 24 hours in advance.
Wahidi is a medical case manager for Catholic Social Services. Most of the students are from Afghanistan, like him, and a few are from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Wahidi says people don't have to make appointments when they get sick in Afghanistan.
If you call to schedule an appointment, they will just tell you you are the number two, you are number three. They don't give you a specific time. This is the time that you have to come.
Many refugees may have left traumatic situations or a country at war, but within 30 days of arriving, they need to have a thorough health screening. They may get vaccines and will get tested for contagious diseases like tuberculosis or syphilis. Navigating this visit is one more hoop they have to jump through, often in a new language. Wahidi says his goal is to help refugees become independent. He teaches people how to ride the bus and how to make their own appointments. And Montoya says she teaches clients to advocate for themselves.
I learned that I can speak up and I say, I don't want the doctor. I need another one. So, and that's the thing that I try to teach my clients, like, you have voice, you have rights.
Refugees have a lot to navigate coming to Alaska, but Wahidi and Montoya's work means that hopefully the confusion of the medical system won't add to that. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Bears getting into trash is a problem throughout Southeast Alaska. To deal with it locally, the city of Hoonah started distributing free bear-resistant trash bins to residents at the beginning of the month. But as Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports, most towns in the region can't afford them.
In the fall, bears are interested in one main thing, getting fat to survive the winter. They do that by gorging on salmon, grazing on berry bushes, and at times, getting into trash bins.
Almost daily from this time on into late November.
Dennis Gray is the city administrator for Hoonah, a small community on the northeastern side of Chichagof Island. The island has the world's densest population of brown bears. Gray says in the fall, bears are a daily problem.
We have thousands of brown bears and less than 1,000 people. So bears have been here for a long time and we have constant conflicts.
It's a familiar problem all over Southeast. Haines killed nearly 30 brown bears in 2020. The following year, Sitka euthanized 14 brown bears. But so far, Hoonah is the only community in Southeast that's providing bear-resistant trash cans. Gray thinks they'll be a game-changer for the community.
I'm pretty excited about this.
The bear bins were too expensive for Hoonah until a large grant came their way, $2 million from Norwegian Cruise Lines. The company gave Hoonah the money during COVID. The city used it to purchase 660 bins at $136 a pop. They're smaller sized because they must be lifted and dumped by a person, since Hoonah doesn't have a mechanical collection truck. In Sitka, such bear bins have been cost prohibitive. Sitka created a bear task force, which met about 10 times last year. They recommended that the city and borough invest in bear-resistant cans. But Sitka would need to spend around $1.5 million to replace all its residential bins. It boils down to money for other towns in the region, too, who instead rely on laws and citations to encourage residents to keep trash secured. Sitka's wildlife biologist, Stephen Bethune, says brown bears have been getting into local trash bins for many years.
The bears have keyed in on that and, you know, roam the neighborhoods at night looking for cans with trash in them.
The bear bins are kind of like water-resistant clothing. They help for a while.
There's no such thing as bear-proof. That's why we call them bear-resistant.
And they have proof of this. At a local bear shelter in Sitka, Fortress of the Bear, staff tested out many so-called bear-resistant trash bins. The very best one lasted only 12 minutes, but Bethune says that's enough.
I don't foresee, realistically, a bear spending 10 minutes on one trash can.
Purchasing bear-resistant trash bins is just one step Hoonah is taking with the grant money. The city also bear-proofed its landfill with concrete blocks. They purchased bear-resistant metal dumpsters and kits for hanging deer safely in the fall. And they're bringing in a bear canine team from Fairbanks for 2 weeks to scare the bears away. Gray says if it works, they'll bring the team back next year. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.